from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next up on this morning's forum program, success may not be something often associated with trauma, but two Bay Area psychologists have spent years examining success in the wake of suffering and distress. We'll discuss what makes certain individuals achieve great things after great suffering with the authors of Super Survivors, The Surprising Link Between Suffering and Success. That's up next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum program. Two Bay Area psychologists join us for this morning's second forum hour. David Feldman, Associate Professor of Counseling Psychology at Santa Clara University, and psychotherapist Lee Kravitz are co-authors of a book called Super Survivors, which brings to our attention individuals who go beyond mere survival in the wake of or the aftermath of trauma and move forward through their lives with resilience and what the two co-authors call grounded hope. Both Lee Kravitz and David Feldman join us. Welcome them to Forum. Good morning.
Thanks very much.
Glad to have you both here. Actually, when I say what you call grounded hope, it goes back to your education, Dave Feldman, where you were at the University of Kansas studying psychology and had a mentor who gave you this concept, grounded hope. Let's talk about that.
Absolutely. Well, he didn't call it grounded hope. He called it simply hope. But his name is Rick Snyder. C.R. Snyder is what he published under. And he was just a luminary. Hope has been around as a concept for, you know, as long as humanity has.
Time immemorial.
But he was really the first psychologist to say, let's study it scientifically. We can assess this. We can figure out the ingredients that go into it. And we can also try to discern how to train people in it. So it's not just you're either a naturally sort of hopeful thinker or not, but we can teach people to be more hopeful. And that has all kinds of positive outcomes.
And it doesn't necessarily, Lee Kravitz, have a happy face on it. It's not necessarily like Norman Vincent Peale's, according to your research, The Power of Positive Thinking. It's maybe more to be realistic and have that realistic realism combined with hope. Yeah,
that's exactly right. That's the concept behind grounded hope. It's the idea that you don't paint a smiley face over the situation. You look at it square in the eyes and say, this is the issue that I'm dealing with. And at the same time, looking at what you can do at the same time as being very specifically grounded in the reality of the situation.
Let's, in fact, look at some of the people that you profile here, because some of these stories are really quite moving and get to the heart of really what the thesis of the book is. And there's, for example, a young woman who self-defined herself as a party girl and named Amanda. And she was in a coma for a month after a water skiing accident and then had a brain injury and all that. Even notwithstanding all that, she was able to kind of turn a business around and move forward and move forward in a successful and very resilient way.
Absolutely. So Amanda Weigel is an amazing person. And one of the things we loved about her was that, you know, when you meet her, she just seems like a normal girl. She's wonderful and warm. And before she had her traumatic brain injury a couple years ago, she had she called herself a party girl. She was a sorority girl. She had a lot of friends. She was on a lake water skiing, and she had a water skiing accident and hit her head, and blood poured into the water. And about a month later, she woke up and from her coma. And it turns out she had to relearn how to walk and how to talk and how to think. And at the same time, she also relearned that she was actually the owner of a small business in Phoenix, Arizona called Brandables. It's a company that puts logos on T-shirts and cups and things like that. And it turns out when she went into the water, it was right when the economy started to bottom out. So she was able to resurrect her life as well as the business itself. It became a multimillion dollar company. And she did this. We asked her how she did this, and she said it was really because she had tremendous social support. But what was interesting is that when she went into the water and she came back out, many of her friends kind of disappeared. And it turned out she didn't have the kind of social support that we would on the outside say, wow, you know, you have a lot of people helping you out. So when we asked her what kind of social support she was talking about, she said, well, I had my mother and my fiance
So one of the principles that we talk about in the book is the principle of perceived social support. You know, everyone asks, is it the quality or the quantity of social support that matters? And the last two or three decades of research shows that it's actually neither. It's the degree to which people perceive that social support will be available to them in the future. So it's not how much or what's available now. And the key is, even though people had turned their back on her because they didn't know how to support her through her brain injury, she always thought there would be someone there for her should she need it in the future, because she always believed she could count on these two people, her fiancé and her mom. So she credits this sense of future availability of social support with what buoyed her up and got her to rehab everything.
This is sort of the common thread in many of these stories, that is looking forward or being able to progress or thinking that there's a future.
Right.
And that really does tie in with hope. We have Cindy Sheehan here, many of our listeners are familiar with, who lost her son. And you have a story of a woman named Clementine who managed to survive the slaughter in Rwanda. Some of these stories are, as I said, really amazing stories. But just wondering, you know, how much of this has to do with super survivors we're talking about here. Maybe a special breed of people who can move toward a future. I mean, you talk about the importance of being realistic and forgiving and moving forward and all that, but maybe it's temperament. Maybe it's nature and the DNA that people have that can allow them to go on that track, as opposed to sort of assimilating or absorbing the idea that, because we got some of this from Malcolm Gladwell too, you know, that if you suffer or if you have adversity, you can do well.
Well, I think there are two things that in your question, which I think are fantastic to point out. One is, nowhere in the book are we saying that suffering is good or that adversity is good.
Trauma, not even that it's noble?
Trauma, tragedy, not even that it's noble, perhaps. Trauma and tragedy, I think, are bad. They're painful. They lead to all kinds of negative outcomes. What we celebrate in the book isn't necessarily that trauma is somehow good. It's that the human psychological system, the human spirit, if you will, if you want to get poetic, really has the ability to, even in the worst of circumstances, to bounce forward, to be resilient, to do great things. And the interesting thing for me as a psychologist, because I have to admit, when I started researching this topic years ago, I expected temperament, you know, inborn sort of personality or early childhood personality to play a huge role. And there are certainly some personality variables. But I think what the take-home message of the book is that actually the majority of what helps people to become super survivors isn't temperament. It's actually skills, ways of thinking that are future-focused.
Things that you can learn.
That can be learned.
Because there is a thesis underlying the thesis here that most people can benefit from what these so-called super survivors represent, and that people can apply these kinds of skills and learn what they are. And yet, I'm just wondering, because for example, there was a new study that was released yesterday, and this is a promo for tomorrow's program, found that 1 in 6 California adults experience significant childhood stress in the form of abuse, neglect, or family dysfunction. This is kind of a shocking statistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We've got one of the authors of that report on scheduled to be on tomorrow with Scott Schaefer, Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris of the San Francisco Center for Youth Wellness. So this is a plug for that program at 9 a.m. But it also found that toxic stress significantly increases their odds of having dementia, Alzheimer's disease, other health problems.
That's true. In fact, I'm surprised it's only 1 in 6, because the research actually shows that somewhere in the neighborhood of 50% to 80% of people at some point during our long lives will encounter a serious trauma. So 1 in 6, I suppose, in childhood sounds about right, but that's low compared to what we'll encounter. And I think the other thing that's important to say is that post-traumatic growth and post-traumatic stress are not mutually exclusive. So the research is really clear that often the people who grow the most are also the people who suffer the most. And a lot of the people that we talk to in the book, one of them you mentioned was Clementine Wemeraya, who survived genocide and 20 years later is a Yale graduate and is doing fantastically living in the U.S., speaks for the U.N. She is absolutely a super survivor, has grown immensely and has touched the world in dramatic ways, but she continues to cry and have memories and have nightmares. I don't think you can skip over the suffering and go straight to the growth.
You can't be a good person and grow without suffering?
Oh, I think you can, but I think it's unrealistic. realistic to ask people to encounter the worst possible things that any of us can imagine and not suffer. I think that the message that it's possible to have trauma and just instantly snap back and be happy and be positive.
That's a bad message.
Is one of the things we take issue with.
But I may take issue also with the message that you can somehow always grow from suffering if you have learned skills to be able to deal with the suffering. I mean, there's just some people who are better at adapting after PTSD, for example, or not falling into depression and staying there than other people. Mm-hmm. And it almost seems innate in some ways. I mean, I'm talking, of course, just from my own anecdotal wisdom for whatever it's worth. But it seems to me that some people are inclined to be able to overcome trauma better than others. And there's certainly learning. I mean, there's learning to overcome physical trauma and to rehabilitate and all that through physical rehabilitation. But it seems to me that attitude is an important part of this.
It's interesting. Yeah, well, we talk a lot about positive thinking. Yes, and we talk about, you know, positive thinking and where does positive thinking really come into play here. And what we found was that positive thinking really doesn't matter nearly as much as we originally thought. It was one of the counterintuitive principles that we ran into. You know, we ran into a guy named Alan Locke, a fascinating, fascinating young man.
He's the guy with macular degeneration.
That's exactly right. Yeah. He's this young guy. He's in the Royal Marines, and he decides that this is what he wants to do with his life. He spends his entire young adult life working to become a career Marine. And one night he's on duty and he can't read the writing on his charts. And when he looks down, it's all fuzzy. And the next morning, his vision's getting even worse. Cut to a couple of days later, the doctor tells him he has macular degeneration and he's going to go blind very, very fast. And he decides, you know, he wants to try to continue to be upbeat, but no matter how positive he is in attitude, he continues to lose things. He loses his vision. He loses his post in the Marines. He loses his independence. Cut to a year later, he becomes the first person to get into a rowboat blind and row across the Atlantic Ocean. He's in the Guinness Book of World Records for it. And we asked him, you know, what was it that allowed you to do this remarkable thing? And he said, well, I'll tell you what it wasn't. It wasn't positive thinking.
Yeah, you guys do a lot to eschew positive thinking, or at least to say that it's not as important as many people believe it is. My mother always told me, think positively, but we'll leave her out of this. but I saw you did an article in Psychology Today about the lyrics to the Monty Python song, The Life of Brian, Always Look on the Bright Side, and deconstructed it and took it apart and said, research says maybe you know, positive thinking isn't as connected to resilience as many of us like to think it is.
Yeah. So certainly I think we need to admit positive thinking is better than negative thinking, right? However, there's probably sort of a middle ground here. I mean, when you've just suffered the worst thing you can imagine, a trauma, let's say you've been diagnosed with cancer, a common piece of advice for people to get is look on the bright side, smile and be happy, look for the silver lining. And the truth is that if you've just suffered a terrible trauma, it's very hard to do that. You don't feel like it. So a lot of people that I've met clinically say that that piece of advice was very damaging to them, that they felt like people were saying, don't admit how you feel. You know, try to deceive yourself. And they felt like they were being asked to lie to themselves and they felt very alienated. So what we do in the book is we say, well, maybe it's not about positive thinking. Maybe it's not about negative thinking. Maybe it's about realistic thinking. And that really gets to what you were talking about grounded hope. Is in grounded hope, it's this notion that you first ground yourself in what is realistically happening to you. Don't paint a smiley face over it. So we heard people say, yeah, I went blind. I can't get my vision back. Yes, I've lost my leg. I can't go back in time and make that all better. But then once you admit bravely what is happening to you, there's the hope piece, which is to say, given where I am, given the fact that the place that I am, frankly, is not a great one, how can I move forward in my life? How can I build the best life I can on top of this? And to begin to marshal your strengths to put one foot in front of the other and move towards the goals that are possible for you.
So it's believing in the future, really, is what you're talking
about.
But also being able to maybe realize that you can't change the past or that,
right.
I mean, that realism. We're talking again with the co-authors of Super Survivors, Surprising Link Between Suffering and Success, David Feldman and Lee Kravitz. Is there a concern that you have, though, that when you give out the message that there is a link between suffering and success, that maybe people will think, oh, I want to be successful, I got to suffer.
Well, actually, one of the things we say in the book at the very end is that all of the people – and by the way, we did about 150 interviews for this book. We ended up featuring 17 extraordinary super survivors, and all of them said that the reason they participated in these interviews is that they wanted – people to learn from what they had experienced so that people can become quote-unquote super survivors, live meaningful lives without having suffered the trauma. So no, I don't think there's anything essential about trauma. I think you can be successful without trauma and suffering.
Of course, when you talk about resilience, you're also talking about maybe character building or grit or things of that sort. There's a Harvard Business Review article recently that suggested that presenting adversity as a requirement for character building is problematic. Let me just read this to you. I worry that the narrative of surmounting adversity is becoming too idealized. Triumph over disaster is rightly seen as a laudable part of a person's experiences, but it's now sometimes pretended as a requirement. Peek into the basement of any successful light, and you'll see that they, too, are founded on failure. That's according to someone who's on the side of adversity leads to. That argument overreaches. In fact, I'm more taken by the observation that many of the things we consider failures are really accidents driven by random events or simple mistakes, and often there's no lesson to be learned or silver lining to be found.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think there is a silver lining in trauma, and I don't think that there's necessarily a lesson to be learned. I think that's true. But I do think that people have the ability to marshal strengths and move forward after trauma, sometimes in dramatic ways. So I think it is dangerous to send the message that in order to grow, you've got to suffer. I don't think that's true. But I think it's important.
Yeah, that may be the message some people are taking.
Oh, yeah. And we take great pains in the book to try to dispel that. But I know that that's something that inadvertently can come across. I think the message is more one of hope, which is trauma doesn't have to be the end. It's very interesting to me. Actually, Malcolm Gladwell wrote an article a number of years ago that it was called Getting Over It in The New Yorker. And he talked about our culture's reticence to accept the notion that people can be resilient. There's this idea in our culture that if you've suffered trauma, if you've suffered setbacks, that you're just going to suffer for the rest of your life, that these things sort of hold on forever. I think that probably traces its way back to Freud, right, and the notion that traumas just sort of hold on and affect us unconsciously. But actually, if you look at the research, what you find is people are astoundingly resilient.
Well, there's also a lot to be said for this culture teaching people that Americans are, you know, people who reach for high bars and, you know, individualism and all that kind of.
Two competing messages, which I think is fascinating.
That's often the case with this particular culture that we live in. We're talking, by the way, with the authors of Super Survivors, co-authors Lee Kravitz and David Feldman. And we'll bring you into this conversation. You also talk about something you call competitive optimism. And the idea is, I think, to be strong-willed, at least in part. I think at least that's what I glean as a reader. A lot of this has to do with the bringing Nietzsche here, but the triumph of the will. You know, how strong are people's wills and how much can they grow and thrive from adversity may just be their sense of determination and their sometimes obstinacy and hard-headedness and all of that. This is a complicated, nuanced subject, to be sure.
Yeah.
And yet it's one that raises the question, if there are characteristics of resilience, if there's something that people share after a trauma that allows them to thrive, what is it?
What is the
Let's
one
crystallize
characteristic?
Well, I'm not saying it's like it's monolithic, believe me. But I'm saying, you know, are there things that we can extract and say, what are they?
Yes. I would say there are probably four things. And the first one is, it goes back to what we've been talking about. Look at things realistically and honestly. Don't attempt to paint a smiley face. Admit the way you're feeling in the aftermath of trauma. You know, painting a smiley face, denying what's happening can feel good in the short term, but it can actually prevent you in the long term from taking the steps you need to make things better. I think a second thing is, this is one we haven't really talked about, be willing to give up on a goal when it's not working. So often what trauma does is block us in our goals. So we were talking about Alan Locke.
Make us feel we can't have those goals or even have goals themselves.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, I mean, Alan Locke would never have gotten into a rowboat and rowed across the Atlantic Ocean blind if he hadn't given up on the idea that he was going to be in the Marines forever, or given up on the idea even that he was going to get his vision back. To be said, I mean, to be fair, giving up is really, really hard. It's not an easy thing to do at all. It's incredibly, incredibly painful. It's a horribly painful process many times. But giving up can also mean it opens you up to new opportunities and new goals. As long as you have a new goal, then you have hope.
Right. So this is
talking about
one of those
goals. We'll get
things.
To the other 2 points in a minute. I know, Dave, you want to get to
sure.
those. But talking about maybe the power to accommodate.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what we're talking about? Is that, I don't know if it's one of your four, but
yeah, it's not one of the four, but we do talk about in the book this notion that we all, if provided we're raised in, you know, reasonably decent homes, you know, reasonably decently dysfunctional, if you will, we all sort of develop a sense that the world is a pretty okay place where good things happen to good people. And we're pretty good people. I mean, that's sort of what most, particularly Americans, I think.
Sounds a little Pollyannish believe. To me. There are people
it
who
is.
Are raised in homes that are unloving and
oh,
abusive.
Oh, absolutely.
And,
mm-hmm. you know, so I mean, let me try to dispel that a little bit. So there's a woman named Ronnie Janoff Bowman who's done a lot of research on this, and she's very clear to say that these assumptions are actually unconscious. That it's not the case that most people would admit that they have them. And yet she says, if we didn't believe that the world was a pretty okay place where basically good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people.
That's positive thinking, isn't it?
It would be very hard for us to get in the car this morning and fling ourselves down a highway at 70 miles an hour and speed when we have all these cars around us. It would be very hard for us to watch the news without being terrified. So she says having these assumptions on some level allows us to function. Here's the thing, though. When trauma happens, and here's where it can get in our way. When trauma happens, if we try to maintain these assumptions at all cost, it can actually ultimately be damaging to us. If instead we sort of look at them and grapple with them and say, you know what? I used to believe the world was a totally good place where good things happen to good people. I think now I need to restory that, to realize that maybe the world isn't so good and sort of believe that in my gut. That this process of sort of rebuilding your worldview in a new way can ultimately be a good thing.
If you're still believing it in your gut, though, you're positive thinking.
Oh, no. You need to overturn that and not believe it in your gut anymore.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you clarified that because you were talking about, you know, looking at the world as a good place and keeping that.
No. I think reconstructing that, finding a new way of seeing the world.
That's
that
resiliency,
is more realistic.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it is. It is. And, you know, again, we talk about, when our worldview shatters, it's a really painful thing. In the book, we actually compare it to the Mythbusters. We talk about, you know, trying to break a myth that you in your heart believe is absolutely true. It would be as though Dave and I were saying to, you know, Michael, the sky is not really blue, it's red. And it's red every day that you wake up, or purple. And in your head, in your heart, you know that it is blue. That is a worldview. The sense that the world's a good place, good things happen to good people, and I'm a good person, so good things are going to happen to me. And when that shatters, and we have to reconstruct it, and that is ultimately more beneficial for us.
You have to realize that the sky is actually red.
Well, actually, there's a story that comes to mind by Ernest Gaines where there's a young man who says, well, sky could be gray. We don't know. You know, sky
That's
could
right.
be orange. We have to prove otherwise. Let me do this. Let me open the phone lines and invite those of you listening to join this conversation. Here are a couple of Bay Area psychologists with us who explore why trauma can make us stronger. And what do you think about that? David Feldman, Associate Professor of Counseling Psychology at Santa Clara University, and Lee Kravitz, a psychotherapist, co-authors of Super Survivors, A Surprising Link Between Suffering and Success. Our toll-free number available now. It's 866-733-6786. You, our listeners, may want to bring in your own experiences, or you may bring in questions or comments, but feel free to join us again. Toll-free, you can do that now at 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments right onto our website, which is kqed.org/forum. And click on this segment, and you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, but please feel free to join the program, and we'll go to your calls and emails. When we return, you're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with a couple of Bay Area psychologists, Lee Kravitz and David Feldman, who have written a book called Super Survivors, and it's all a book. It's a book all about really surviving strong, surviving, and to some extent, accommodating to suffering and making oneself stronger. And what really allows for that. And there are some amazing stories in here. There's also a story I'm sure many of you are familiar with about Betty Williams, the Nobel recipient who witnessed senseless killing in Northern Ireland. And that trauma had a lot to do with her becoming the leader she was for the peace movement. We also asked our listeners on Twitter what allowed them to overcome trauma. And let me just read some of these responses. Sonia tweets, "The love of one parent and religion, but I'm an atheist now, through traumatic childhood and great brain balancing therapy, especially eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing EMDR therapy." We've done programs on that somewhere buried in our archives. Another listener tweets, "Someone else who cared." And Elizabeth tweets, "Our two kids both have issues. One had leukemia, okay now, one autistic. We find blinders helpful, concentrating only on the moment." Mm-hmm. And another tweet, "I don't like the word stronger. My bipolar hasn't made me stronger. It's forced me to develop better coping and living techniques." So you get some of the range of what we're talking about here. And actually, David Feldman was outlining 4 points about how people thrive better or what makes them or allows for them to thrive better. We only got halfway through that. You had 2 other points, so please.
Well, this one really goes with the person who posted it on Twitter, and that is notice and be open to receiving social support. So that's one that we found all throughout the book, is that, you know, you not only need to have the social support available, and not everyone does, I think we need to admit that, but the important thing is noticing it. It really is the case that, and I think we all know people who look around them and don't see social support even when it's actually there. So really being open to it.
Let me ask you a quick question about that, because never thought I'd be quoting Cardinal Newman here, but he talks about the difference between notional assent and emotional assent, essentially. You know, that, in other words, you can feel something cognitively. You can say, this is the support I have and people support me and they love me and so forth. Or you can feel it in, use your word, the gut, you know, and there's a big chasm sometimes between those two. So,
yeah, I think you need to feel it in both ways. I think that very often the easiest one is to notice that you have social support up in your head. Really feeling it in your gut is a different story. And I think the way to do that, because I've certainly worked a lot with a lot of people who've been through trauma clinically, is to start in little baby steps to actually open yourself up behaviorally to that social support. So when someone offers support, even if you don't believe in your gut that they really want to support you, giving them opportunities to do that and accepting it if it's offered. Because my experience is that sometimes people disappoint, but most of the time people don't. And that—
You're very lucky in your
opening
experience.
Well, keep in mind, I've also seen hundreds of clients. And
I think you've had a golden life. Have you gone through trauma?
No, I'm going to disagree with you. I've seen hundreds of clients who have been through some of the worst things you can imagine, including terminal illness. And, you know, I have to say, I think it's really a fact that I would say 60 to 70% of the time when someone offers you help, they mean it. And I think that the important thing is believing it when someone says that.
Although sometimes it takes a stretch. Sure. Suspension of disbelief.
Yes.
Fourth point.
And the fourth point is a counterintuitive one. And that is, be open to thinking about your own mortality. So there was a research study that was done a few years ago where they took people, just your average people, and they brought them into a lab and they said, I'd like you to think for 20 minutes about your own death. I'd like you to think about when you're going to die, where you're going to die, how you're going to die, what's going to happen to your body after you die. But don't stop there. Also think about what people will say about you after you die, what the legacy is that you hope you leave. And they do that for 20 minutes. And what they found is that people who did that for 20 minutes, as opposed to people who didn't or did some different sorts of tasks, tended after that 20 minutes to be more willing to give to charity, be more generous, less selfish, more spiritual. In other words, take a little step towards—
It's a Scrooge story, basically.
Yeah.
It is.
But we spend so much time trying to avoid thinking about death and our own mortality, and it turns out paradoxically that a little bit of a confrontation with that can inspire us to live a more sort of value-consistent, meaningful life.
Well, that's the story in your book about Connie Chang and her wall of chalk day.
Yeah, God, what a great story. So we ran into it was Candy Chang, and Candy was this again a great world, great person. She's it was an interior designer, and she had a friend of hers who died very young, and this was very shocking to her. And she said, you know, life is short. I'm going to move to New Orleans. This is a place I've always wanted to live. I've always wanted to work. And she didn't just move there at any old time. She moved there right after Hurricane Katrina hit. And so – and the neighborhood that she moved into was the most dilapidated neighborhood in New Orleans. And in her neighborhood, there was she identified one of the most dilapidated houses. And so she got chalkboard paint. You know, it's paint that you can put on a wall and it turns anything into a chalkboard. And she put along the whole side of the house, she made that an entire chalkboard. And in big, big letters up on top, she said, "Before I die, I want to blank." And then she put 80 blanks underneath it, put a bowl of chalk to the side of the house, and just walked away. And it was supposed to be an artistic statement that says, you know, life is short, do what you want to do with it. And she really expected that the thing would be graffitied over within a couple of hours. She comes back the next day and
People love to talk about what their bucket list is.
It really is. It's like a bucket list. But these people filled it in, all 80 lines into the margins, what they want to do with their lives before they die. And there were things like, I want to graduate school. I want to see my kids grow up. I want to drive a pirate ship? Was that one of them?
I want to captain a pirate,
captain a pirate ship.
Some of them were goofy.
Really goofy. But what winds up happening is
Disneyland, yeah.
Exactly. But she winds up erasing it, and the next day it happens again. Now, there are now more than 75 Before I Die walls across the country. There's actually even one here in Hayes Valley we just found out last week in one of the alleyways. And it really calls into relief our dreams just below the surface, that if we think about our mortality, it causes us to think about the things that we want to do before we die.
Well, I want to get to more calls, some of the calls and emails here, not before we die necessarily,
yes,
but before the end of this hour. So let me do that. And this is a caller from Sacramento. Malika, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the program. I was listening to this, and this is very close to home. I think after listening to what the speakers have defined as a super survivor, I include myself in that category. I came to the United States after my husband's sudden demise in a car accident. I came here essentially because of the feudal patriarchal, you know, aspects of, I was a widow with two young girls, no support, no male support in the family. My mother had been recently widowed herself. I don't have a brother, father, etc. So I made the decision to move to the United States, perhaps to give my daughters a better life here. They were 9 and 2 when this accident happened.
Excuse me, Malika, to move from where?
From India, New Delhi.
Okay.
And I moved here with a person who had a PhD degree from University of California, Berkeley. He was an Indian, too, and I thought he was a person who perhaps shares my mindset, is open enough to get away from the conventional mores of India. Came here, realized that he was an abusive person. I had never understood the concept of violence and abuse. That was not my upbringing, not my socialization. I came here, I went to the hospital, and the doctors made me aware that, no, what we see you're going through is domestic violence, and there are resources available. They gave me resources to contact agencies here in the United States. I was here, please understand, by myself, with my two girls after my husband's demise, and an absolutely new culture. I mean, I understood the mindset of individualism and independence and all of that, but logistically, I was all practically alone by myself. So long story short, I had to move out of the house because the situation became untenable. I was helped by agencies here. I lived in shelters, domestic violence shelters. I hate to call them. I was called a battered woman for a long time. I hate the term with a passion. I don't think there was anything, you know, that term by itself, just the semantics can bring you down. So I refute that. Anyways, I stayed in the shelter 2 years. And while I was doing that, my main focus, besides trying to hold two jobs, I didn't understand the social services that were available to someone in my condition. I grew up with a sense of pride in work. So I continued trying to hold two jobs. My essential focus during that time was to make sure that my daughter's spirits were not bruised by all the events that had happened to them. They could fall, scrape their knees, but I wanted to make this uplifting in some way.
Forgive me if I may, Malika, but it sounds like what got you through was not only your own upbringing and the values you had, but also your devotion to your children, to your daughter.
It essentially did. You're very right. It essentially did. My choices were either to sink or swim with these two children on either side holding my hands. And I chose to swim in a culture that was logistically so formidable for me. I drove on the other side of the road. That's where we drive. That's how we drive in India. I had to learn driving here, found myself in oncoming traffic. I mean, I speak about just the regular logistics of being in a foreign culture, but what also helped me, Michael, was I knew that this is not where I would be. I could see where I wanted to be. It was difficult to go there, but I knew I would be there.
Well, you're there. Congratulations for being there. And thank you for that call. It's quite a narrative. It's a periscope that she had. I mean, you don't know where you're going to see on the other end of the periscope, but at least you know that there's not going to be a dead wall or a blind side.
Yeah, there's so much in Malika's account. First of all, Malika, wow. You've been through incredible things, incredibly horrible things, and you've come out the other side, and that's amazing. One of the things that's been our privilege is when we talk about this book, having people come up to us and say, hey, I have a story for you. I'm a super survivor, and just how common this is. And I was struck by so many things. First of all, her devotion to her daughters, you know, the idea of being for another and social support and love being a major factor in helping people to bounce forward. But also I love that she said, see, I could see where I wanted to be. This is sort of part of what grounded hope is, which we talk about.
It's a kind of visualization almost in a way. Huh?
Being able to see the future and say, you know, I don't know exactly where I'm going to end up. I know where I am now. I know where I don't want to be,
well,
which is where I am now.
By the periscope, though, you don't necessarily see what's on the other end. Let me bring some more callers in here. We'll go to Santa Rosa next. Brian, hi. You're on.
Good morning, Michael, and good morning to your guests. I wondered if they had considered the story of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was a man of privilege and wealth, but who was humbled by his bout with polio and brought that to the fore in his leadership with compassionate programs for the common man, something he never was. But his ailment gave him a different kind of success, a success in for all of us in his leadership.
That's an interesting example. You didn't go to historical figures, though.
Well, yeah, we didn't do the historical figures so much, but absolutely he is a super survivor. I mean, you know, while we didn't look at that, we did talk to a number of people who were survivors of illness and survivors, again, of genocide. We spoke to a guy named Aaron Archuria, who survived. He was a Bhutanese refugee, and he wound up using that experience to come to America and start one of the largest anti-torture organizations in the country. We met a woman named Asha Mevlana. Actually, Asha's story is much more similar in the sense that, you know, here's a woman who was in business. She was young, wealthy in Manhattan. At the age of 24, I believe, was diagnosed with breast cancer. This threw her world into a tailspin. And, you know, but for her, it wasn't the chemo, the radiation, or the treatment that was the hardest part. The hardest part for her was bouncing back and figuring out what to do with that experience. What she wound up doing, she didn't go into politics, but what she did do is she decided she was going to take improvisational violin lessons within a year of becoming fairly fluent in violin, moved to L.A. and very quickly got a recording contract with Universal Records and is plays with the American Idol band, is on The Tonight Show. So what we see time and time again are people who take these experiences and use them to either better their position in the world or better the world at large.
Our guests again are Lee Kravitz and David Feldman. They're co-authors of Super Survivors, A Surprising Link Between Suffering and Success. David, you were going to say something?
And to connect with their values, what's important to them. That's one of the things we see over and over again in the story of Asha, but probably also in the story of FDR, is this notion that being through something that is possibly the worst imaginable thing really forces us to look at our mortality and say, you know, am I living the life that I want to live? Who am I? Who do I really want to be in the world? And to connect with what's important to us. And there's research that shows that when we are acting on goals that really are intrinsic, that really are things that are personally meaningful to us, we actually tend to be more successful. We tend to be more motivated. Not always. None of this is a rule always. But I do think that you see that in the story of Asha.
Also talking about authenticity, aren't you? Just really.
Yeah,
let me go to another caller here. Adam, join us. You're on, Adam. Hi.
Hi. I was wanting to know if cognitive behavioral therapy is a good way to get over past traumas, especially if it's been a long-term like 10 years since major trauma, and you've created some patterns that are unhealthy in your, I don't know, in depression. I mean, in my case, back injury and heartbreak, loss of love, and then banishment from family by stepmother for now 10 years. So I'm ready to tackle it, and I'm looking at which therapy modalities would be the best.
Sound like you've been through a lot of pain, Adam. Sorry to hear about that, but he's just asking a practical question here. Cognitive behavioral therapy, can it be of help?
So there are lots of different approaches to therapy, but yes, absolutely. Cognitive behavior therapy is one of them that we know through lots of research and my own personal experience as a cognitive behavior therapist can be really, really helpful. So there are different versions of it. You might have heard of cognitive processing therapy, which is really commonly applied to trauma, or what's sometimes called prolonged exposure therapy. You know, they all work in slightly different ways, but what they have in common is they get you to, instead of sort of running away from denying, avoiding telling your story, to really connect with your story, to tell it in a supportive environment in a way that encourages you, with the therapist's help, to make meaning of what happened.
Hate to use this language, but to own it, really.
You know? To own it and to ask, what does it mean for my life? And how can I take this and in some way move forward with it? What does it tell me about who I am and who do I want to be? That's sort of the process of meaning making and living authentically as someone who's been through really hard times but still has a future. And that's part of what CBT, cognitive behavior therapy, can do.
Adam, good luck to you. I wish you good
luck.
I'm
really dedicated to my future, and it's a question on my mind right now. Also, if it's brought out more patterns of OCD, stronger than I had prior, much stronger, and wondered if I should be open, remain, well, I'm kind of closed to it, so if I should open up to any drugs that a psychiatrist might prescribe.
Well, you have two psychologists in studio here. Mm-hmm. We get into that whole area of psychologists not prescribing, although in some states they're moving that way. Florida, for example, I think they've already moved that way, haven't they?
In various states. I think Arizona maybe too. Yeah. I'm not sure. And certainly in the military. I think the most important thing is for you to find a therapist that you connect with personally. I think that personal connection and somebody that you feel comfortable talking about your story to. And same thing with a psychiatrist or an MD for medication. I think find somebody that you really feel like you can count on.
And thank you, Adam, for your call. I don't want to really get into this in great depth because I said we already did a program on it, but are you too supportive of EMDR?
It's a controversy in the field of psychotherapy.
We should even explain what it is because a lot of listeners don't know.
Yeah, so EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, is an approach which says that over the course of several weeks and several sessions, you tell the story of your trauma in bits and pieces. And while you're doing that, you engage in some kind of, they call it bilateral stimulation. So that can mean moving your eyes back and forth from left to right. It can mean listening to clicks in alternating left and right ears. It can mean feeling vibrations in your hand left and right. And
it's all neurological.
The developers of this think that this stimulates the two hemispheres of the brain, the left and right, in a way that helps you process
memory. It's mainly Francine Shapiro. You said Francine developers.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are other people who have developed sort of extensions to it, and particularly other forms of the bilateral stimulation. But yes, it's Francine Shapiro is the person who originated it. I think the controversy isn't whether it works or not, because there's research that shows very clearly that it works. The controversy is whether that bilateral stimulation, the eye movements, matter. And I think the jury is kind of out on that. My read on it is they may not. But I wouldn't ever steer someone away from EMDR, which can actually be really helpful for some people.
Also interested, we're going to go to more cause in just a moment, but you two did an article that mentioned Adam Johnson mm-hmm. and some of the work he's done, Stanford professor and Pulitzer Prize winner of The Orphan Sons, and it's getting students to write their stories, personal memoirs and expressive writing about, well, having been through trauma. And
sure.
It actually not only enhanced healing, which I suppose, you know, telling a story, writing a story can do, but then I found this research in the article that you alluded to, it was done at State University of New York. It was really baffling about people writing about the trauma of others and that having physical benefit to them.
Yeah, well, I'll start off. I mean, it's interesting.
It's Lee Kravitz.
Yeah, I was at a conference. It was a Lit Camp conference, and I ran into Adam Johnson, who he was 2 weeks shy of winning the Pulitzer. And rather than talk about, you know, his book, The Orphan Master's Son, we started talking about trauma. And now he teaches at Stanford University. He's taking a sabbatical year this year, but his course is about the trauma narrative. And we went on at length about, you know, how wonderful this class is. He has students of writing as well as medical students come into his program, into his class, and write about their trauma, write about their family's trauma. And then not only that, but read each other's stories and narratives about trauma. And he said, you know, I'm not a therapist. I don't know how this works or why it works, but I see a noticeable difference between the start of the quarter and the end of the quarter in the way that people feel. So we decided, you know, this is a great place to start talking about the value and worth of the trauma narrative.
And let me go to some more of these tweets. Again, we ask listeners to weigh in on what helps them cope and move on from trauma. Brian tweets, perspective can help with coping with struggle. Knowing and seeing people who suffered worse can help you move on from your pain. Another listener writes, maintaining a sense of humor. And Dave writes, I like to call it worst case scenario. I imagine the worst case scenario in a situation I'm dealing with, and basically anything less than that is a good thing. And here's LF who writes, I saw Before I Die Wall in New Orleans, which was filled in. I did not know the history behind it. It was inspiring to see because it was a surprise to find it, and it made me think about my bucket list. Let me go to more of your calls here. We'll go to more emails in just a moment, but let me bring on a caller from Mill Valley. Daniel, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate the program. I think it's a very important discussion to have. I teach meditation and life skills to people in recovery in the Bay Area, having been through intense, very severe traumas all the way up until probably 16 years of age. And the one trauma was a severe head injury due to a motorcycle accident. And I took up meditation shortly thereafter because the doctor said I would probably never function in society. Told my parents that. Anyway, which I found out later, but I took up meditation and I eventually went into a monastery and learned cognitive skills. Now I teach those skills in a very secular manner, just as CBT, but also in advanced stages of meditation where you create a different relationship to suffering, and that suffering is experienced as the resistance to the pain of life. Life is just has pain. I think everybody experiences certain pains, but the resistance to it creates suffering. And I think it's an important distinction.
Sounds very Buddhist, actually, Daniel.
It's very Buddhist, but it's also, I think, creating a new kind of relationship to life, that having the experience is the more you avoid it, the more intense the suffering becomes.
Thank you for those thoughts, Daniel. It's good to hear from you, and I appreciate your call. In fact, dovetailing with those are some thoughts from a listener named Merrily, who writes, I've experienced a lot of trying times in my life, mostly related to multiple adoptions and death of spouse. Years ago, I began living with the life theme of, in all the adversity is a seed of an equal or greater benefit. And this allows me to grieve or whatever during the traumatic times, but with the knowledge in the back of my mind that there will be something good or even wonderful in my life that would not have happened had I not suffered the personal traumas. I don't think of this as a silver lining, but rather a willingness to look back and see what good happened as a result of the trauma. Of course, we get back to the thought that sometimes there's no good that comes out of trauma.
Absolutely. Sometimes there is no good that comes out of trauma. But, I mean, these two callers and the writer really bring up what's essential in our perspective about grounded hope. You know, I think one of the things that mindfulness meditation teaches is to be aware of the present moment, yes, but also not to run away from your pain, not to try to paint a smiley face over it, to acknowledge it, to say, yes, this is happening to me. And I think there is something about...
But not to let it take you over.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. There's something about admitting what's happening and then saying, but there's still a future for me.
And here's a listener, Elizabeth, who says, how does silence sustain trauma? Whistleblowers, for example, can't talk with others about the circumstances of trauma or abused employees, that sort of thing.
I think that there's a huge stigma in our culture against talking about trauma. And one of the things that we hope this book accomplishes is to send people the message that it's okay to talk about it.
Depending who you talk to, though.
Absolutely. And I think we certainly need to be careful. You don't want to, you know, endanger your career. But I think that the more we as authors, as radio hosts, talk about trauma, detoxify it by saying it's not necessarily the end. It's not something that happens to losers. It's something that happens to all of us. And there is a future for us. The more people will be willing to talk about, write about, think about their trauma. And that helps people be resilient.
Well, we have a caller from Boulder Creek. Lorraine, we only have about a minute left or so, but go ahead. It's yours.
Okay. First of all, I haven't read the book, but I did hear your 4 points. And I just wanted to add something that you just mentioned, someone who wrote in who said, every trauma, there's a seed for something new. And I want to expand on that a bit. For me, it's a pendulum. And if you have a really bad experience, it swings you so far in one direction that you really need to do something to bring it back. You know, you have to put your, you know, your life experience and your life energy has to somehow recoup that to balance you out. And I was, I've had multiple traumas, but one of them was a brain injury received after being mugged in a carjacking. And I was told I'd never work again, but I went back to school and graduated with honors after that because I wasn't going to settle for that. I really wanted to sort of fight back. And I also had another situation where someone very dear to me, two people were diagnosed with cancer, and my response to that was I sailed around the world.
So you're a fighter, and I think, you know, resilience sometimes can be almost synonymous with being a fighter, and I thank you for that call. I want to get one more listener comment on here. This is a listener who writes, my mom was really a survivor, and I think my sister and I could say the same, like most people. It does bother me, though, when I hear psychologists or anyone talk about negative feelings. Some in my family believe that having positive or so-called negative feelings is absolutely a matter of choice and have no sympathy for sadness or depression. I wish more people would understand that the attitudes one has are not, if ever, a matter of choice. If one feels very depressed or anxious, certainly not a matter of choice. Antidepressants help marvelously, but telling someone to think positively and not to have negative thoughts is insensitive in my experience.
Totally agree. Okay. Totally agree.
Hit the jackpot with you on that point.
Definitely.
Thank you both. Again, the book is Super Survivors. Dave Feldman, Lee Kravitz, thank you for being with us.
A real pleasure.
And thank you, our listeners. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.